Thank you so much for joining us on WKOK Sunrise. Mark Lawrence here, Rob Center there, our fabulous producer. We always appreciate his help and hard work and all he does, all the work he does to keep us going every single morning. Well, this morning on the Newsline, we're honored to say that Jeff McCausland is on the line. He's a CBS News military analyst. You've heard him in the hourly news and on some of their features. He's a retired U.S. Army colonel and educator, has taught at Dickinson College here in Pennsylvania, and his third book is out. He co-authors that with another individual, Battle Tested: Gettysburg Leadership Lessons for the 21st Century Leaders, with Tom Vossler. Good morning, Jeff. Thank you so much for calling in this morning.
Hey, Mark. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
I really do appreciate it. First and foremost, thank you so much for your service and for all you're doing to make sure that leadership is really brought up and talked about and passed on here and written about. So thank you for all that. We appreciate that. Lessons for today. In the book, you say General Lee and General Meade had the right ideas. They were all lacking in certain areas, but and of course had abundance in others. So what is the key lesson in leadership that's the takeaway in your book that we can use today?
Well, there are numerous ones you can take away. I guess one might be if you talk about Lee and you talk about Meade, of course, they were in very different leadership roles at that particular moment. Lee had been in command for about 16, 18 months. He had been very, very successful in the previous battles. And in many ways, I would describe Robert E. Lee in the 19th century, in the South at least, as a rock star. And his challenge, I think, at Gettysburg were twofold. One is that I think he really believed that his army could do whatever he told him to do and did not listen much to those below him. Peter Longstreet tried to advise him on several occasions that making this frontal assault on the third day against the Union line would not be successful, but he discarded all that and kept on going. Second of all, I think Robert E. Lee perhaps was not aware of himself, and I think leaders today, particularly in the crises we're involved in at this moment, need to be very aware of himself. There seems to be pretty clear evidence that he was suffering from dysentery, he was suffering from a bad back. In fact, some believe he may have had a mild heart attack while at Gettysburg. So while he's making these monumental decisions, he was not in the best form, and I don't think pay much attention to that. And I think leaders today need to pay attention to caring for themselves as they deal with crises that may last for a long period of time. On the other side, of course, Meade had only been in command about 3 days, so his situation is quite different. And as a consequence, on the evening of the second day of the battle, the most important day of all, he meets with his senior leadership and talks to them and actually solicits from them what they think we ought to do on the third day: attack, defend, or actually pull away from Gettysburg and go someplace else. And they actually take a vote. And I think there's another lesson for leaders today in that they need to solicit input from below but try to build consensus as the organization moves ahead. I'm firmly convinced that George Meade had already decided they were going to stay at Gettysburg, but going through that discussion, going through that vote, soliciting that input from below was an effort by him to build consensus in the organization so everybody's moving ahead with the maximum possible strength in the direction that they have decided.
Now, in the book, you talk a great deal about precisely what is success, you know, this idea of what President Lincoln wanted, what General Meade thought was success. Elaborate on that for them and then bring that to maybe today's world.
Yeah, I think leader needs to decide what is success, how do we measure success, what does success look like, you know, because things may work out. We oftentimes think about what's going to happen if things don't work, and we have contingencies for everything when things go astray. But how do we actually exploit success? Sometimes we don't sit down and think that through. And we've seen organizations today have monumental success and perhaps now trying to exploit this. I was reading last night, for example, that Zoom, for example, has grown in the final quarter of 2020 by 340%, a success perhaps that they could not imagine. But you're right there, after the third day of the Battle of Gettysburg, of course, the Confederates are defeated, and on July 4th and late in the day, they began their withdrawal. But Meade does not pursue, many believing that that moment there was a chance for absolute success for the Union, that is ending the war, because a major victory had also occurred at Vicksburg on that same day. But there's one other interesting thing about that, Mark, and that is Abraham Lincoln, who is despondent when he receives a message from Meade saying, "Mr. President, I have defended the nation from invasion." He's despondent because Lee gets away and gets back to Virginia. He writes a letter to Meade, and it begins with, "My dear General, You can't defend the nation because it's one nation. Back to defining what success looks like. Winning the war is success, not just defeating Robert E. Lee. But then what he does is very interesting, I think a lesson for leaders. And then as he folds that letter up, he puts it in his desk drawer, and he retires for the evening. And the next morning he comes up, looks at the letter again, and he never sends it. He never sends it because he needs Meade, to continue in command, which Meade does until the end of the war.
Well, you also talk in the book about vision, and maybe Lee and Meade have different visions, and so that might be a key difference. I'm always so impressed when someone can define, or when I meet somebody with vision that really can not just see what's happening around them, but kind of thinks big and can see the future. Tell us more about that for today's leaders.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, leaders have got to define the vision for their organization, where they're going, and their mission, vision, and values in an organization are key. And I find it strange when I work with corporations and large organizations that too oftentimes the leader doesn't use where I want the organization to go as a guiding light and something he talks to his organization frequently about that. I worked with Hilton Corporation at one time, for example, and their leader at the time told me that he spent his first year traveling around through all the different Hilton hotels around the world just to make sure that everybody understood where he wanted to go and talking about the mission, vision, and values of the organization. But the classic example of that at Gettysburg, of course, is Abraham Lincoln, who comes up to the Gettysburg on the 19th of November. I believe the story of Gettysburg has to include the speech. And in that speech he delivers that afternoon, he casts a new vision for the nation, the speech concluding, of course, with those immortal words, a new birth of freedom. And I think really what occurs right there is Lincoln's vision that the war up to this point has been about preserving the Union, but now it's about ending slavery. Those two things, preserving the Union and ending slavery, are inextricably linked. And so as those 15,000 people arrive in the cemetery for that occasion and they walk in, the mission is to preserve the Union. When they walk out, it's now those two things, preserve the Union and end slavery.
You talk about some leaders today might enjoy what President Lincoln did. You had talked about President Lincoln put that letter away for a moment. Tell us about what you called reflection, this idea of sort of just a pause. It doesn't have to be overnight, I would suppose. Maybe just a couple hours a day or something like that. Tell me about that versus decisive action or just acting on your impulse versus reflection.
Yeah. Well, leaders need to understand that number one resource they manage in many ways for their organization is time. Why? Because the one thing leaders do that nobody else gets to do is they get to decide, and they get to decide when they're going to decide. And I often say that when you make a decision can be every bit as important as the decision you take. But the leader has got to make sure he or she understands what's the right timing for this particular decision. Can I spend a lot of time reflecting and building consensus, knowing full well perhaps that I'll never get 100% consensus before I move on with this? And Lincoln was a classic example of a person who used reflection and studied while he was in office. He got an enormous amount of books from the Library of Congress and became a student of strategy and military strategy throughout the war, because he thought he needed to do that if he was going to discuss this with the generals, many of whom he fired along the way. Lincoln, in the summertime, about this time of year, the Lincolns would move out of the White House and move to the cottage, which is up where Walter Reed Army Hospital is today. And they would spend their summers until it got colder in the fall there, and he was a commuter back and forth to work. And one reason I think he did that was that idea to allow him a place where he could have a bit of solitude, reflection. That's where he did a lot of his writing. Many believe, for example, that he worked on the Gettysburg Address there at the cottage. So the leader, knowing when I can take some time in my day to reflect, get away from the day-to-day, what I got to decide for today, and reflect on where my organization goes in the future. And that's really the trick for the leader managing his or her personal time. How much time today do I spend on the immediate tasks that need to be done? I can keep myself busy all day, but I need to make sure that I'm reserving some time to think about where's my organization going to be a month from now, 6 months from now, and a year from now.
Well, and then that all circles around back to success. How are you going to define success? You talk about the idea, you know, at what cost is your success, and is it sustainable? So I guess elaborate on that, this idea that even if you come up with a, everybody comes up with a clear vision of success, you almost have to decide whether you want immediate success or long-term success.
Yeah, sustainable success is what you want. And in many ways, what I say, with the most clear demonstration of success by a leader is how his or her organization does after they've left. If the whole organization falls apart when you leave, you really haven't done a very good job of developing a team and developing processes for sustained success. So that's really got to be your goal. You can have some immediate short-term wins, but if those immediate short-term wins are at the cost of the unity of the organization, if you start seeing some of your best members leave your organization because you're driving them into the ground, well, then you're not going to have long-term success. You know, I was reading about Steve Bezos, who maybe is still one of the richest people in the world, and of course runs Amazon. And he was saying in an interview, you know, people come up to me and they talk to me about how well Amazon is doing today. And I usually thank them for that, but frankly, I don't pay much attention to how Amazon's doing today. Now, he can say that, it's a really large organization. What I'm thinking about is how Amazon sustains its success, and where are we at? What is success for us a year from now or 5 years from now?
Well, and of course, I always harken back to one of his anecdotes that he tells us about when he was a kid. He used to find apples that were falling off of trees in municipal areas and sell them to areas where there were no apple trees so that people in those areas could have some apples. So that was his first retailing. Well, I guess he's probably a good example. So is Sam Walton. You talk about some of the ideas that Sam Walton had for his stores early on, very street level, in touch, in contact with management. Kind of reiterate that, how Sam Walton wanted to stay in touch with his workers.
Yeah, he made great efforts to stay in touch with his workforce and learn from them what was working and what was not. And secondarily, of course, to build the consensus on the team that they would sustain themselves in the future. You know, I heard you say the baseball scores before we started, so along with people like Walton, I often use sports examples. And, you know, when I was a kid, I was a big New York Yankees fan. So one of my favorite coaches and sort of philosophers was Yogi Berra. When Yogi Berra manages the New York Yankees to a world championship, the only championship he managed them to an American League championship, I should say, he lost in the World Series, he was interviewed by a sports writer. And the sports writer said, "Yogi, how do you build a world championship team?" And Yogi looked at him and said, "You hire world championship players, you know." But Joe Maddon, who's the manager now of the Angels and was the manager of the Cubs, and now I'm a Cubs fan, after the Cubs win the 2016 World Series, he was interviewed about this whole thing. And he said, "You know, my job as a manager is to examine data and determine what data, you know, describes how well we're doing, like how fast the pitcher throws the ball, how fast a guy runs, how fast the ball goes off the bat. And I can get all kinds of data on how we're doing as an organization. What I've got to decide is which of this data is really important and focus on that. Otherwise, I can just be inundated with data because we can acquire data so well in the modern age." But then he said, "When I acquire a player, though," so management's really about data and about complexity. "When I think about getting a new player, whether I recruit him, whether I trade for him, whether I draft him, I want to know about heartbeat. I want to know about his or her heartbeat. So we interview their wife, their ex-wife, their girlfriend, their ex-girlfriend, their roommate in college, etc., because we want to know, despite how good that person might be, will he fit into that team?" And that's back to Walton, that's back to Yogi Berra. Hearing from the team and acquiring new people, but are they going to fit into the team? Because, of course, we're looking for something where the sum is greater than the parts in terms of the success, and that'll head us in the direction of sustained success.
Anything else critically important about the book that you really want to pass along that maybe I didn't ask you?
Well, the one thing I think, ironically, when you write a book like this, actually you finish it as the author maybe 6 months to even a year prior to seeing it in print, and the rest of that's publication and review by the publishers. As we finish this book, Tom and I, which was done about a year ago, of course, we were just in the onset of the pandemic. And really, the book is about leaders in a crisis, because a crisis compresses time, and you see good leadership and bad leadership sticking out in bold relief, and it demands your ability to adapt, it demands your ability to react to those pressures. Well, in reality, that's what we've seen going on for leaders for the last year, as they are confronted, I would argue, about three crises right now. Certainly the pandemic and what that's meant for every organization in every part of the world, literally. Second of all, here in the United States, we have a crisis in many ways of social justice and people's faith in government, which will endure, unfortunately, even after, I'm afraid, the pandemic goes away. And then we have an economic crisis that affects organizations and individuals. So in many ways, our book comes out, though it was never planned like that, to talk about leadership and leadership, particularly during a crisis, and those enduring principles and concepts. But I really think the application to our current circumstance is even much more poignant.
Well, maybe Governor Wolf won't be so. Maybe history won't be unkind to Governor Wolf.
Maybe I should send him a copy.
like today. He's got plenty of critics today, but maybe time will turn his actions into the Gettysburg Address. You know, that wasn't always as well received back then.
Well, it's interesting you say that real quick. The Patriot newspaper, and I don't mean the great newspaper up in Harrisburg, if you check back on the commentator who shows up at Gettysburg, actually would write in the newspaper the next day, "The president made a few idiotic remarks yesterday at Gettysburg," and that was the initial review.
Oh, geez.
They did print a retraction in 2013.
Just recently. Well, yeah, didn't they say that hopefully they'll be quickly overlooked or something like that?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
yeah.
Super. Jeff, thank you so much. You got an open mic here anytime. I'd love to explore this again, and you foolishly gave us your contact information, so we'll be back in touch, and I just really appreciate your help today.
Be glad to do that, Mark. Have a good day.
Thank you. That is Jeff McCausland, a retired U.S. Army colonel, CBS News military analyst. You've heard him lately talking about President Biden versus Iran in that conversation that's underway. Educator and author of a new book, Battle Tested, Gettysburg Leadership Lessons for the 21st Century Leaders, written with Tom Vossler. It's a Simon & Schuster book, if you're looking in that way. Of course, most folks getting their books Audible or Amazon or Barnes & Noble, that kind of thing. But yeah, great book. Had a quick read of it recently, and it's a real inspiration.